When you drive past the Shell gas station in Kensington, Maryland, the crisp and juicy chicken at Leisure World in Silver Spring, Fitzgerald Auto Mall in Rockville, the Home Depot in Falls Church, Virginia, you remember their names, Lori Lewis Rivera, Sarah Ramos, James Buchanan, Linda Franklin. Your mind takes you back to three terrifying weeks.
Sorry, we need an ambulance at the corner of Knowles and Connecticut. A woman was vacuuming her car. Something blew up. She's unconscious. She's got blood coming out of her nose and her mouth.
And where?
Knowles and Connecticut Avenue.
The invisible killer is still out there somewhere tonight. Police here in Rockville and throughout the Washington area are working overtime, hoping to find the sniper before he shoots again.
She's bleeding from the head and she's not moving.
Okay.
Security in everyday life is a feeling that fades with each random shot fired.
We have breaking news right now. If you've been with us, then you know hundreds of police are looking for a sharpshooter who has struck again.
3 weeks in October 2002, a time seared into our memories as two murderous snipers encircled the Washington, D.C. area. A time when we all realized that our life or death in those 22 days was just a matter of chance. I'm Melanie Alnwick. Welcome to our Fox 5 podcast, 3 weeks of hell, the DC snipers. I had just started my third year at the station when all of this happened, and I was working the night side shift. It was really incredible.
Hey, and I'm Bob Barnard. I was here for about 5 years when this all started, and I was actually working a day shift. And Melanie, I remember I was called in earlier than I was supposed to be. And they said, hey, a couple of people have been shot and killed in Montgomery County, like near each other, but we don't think it's related. We don't know. Can you get in here real quick? So I got showered and came right in. By the time I got in, they said, all right, so the third shooting was, and I'm like, what do you mean, a third shooting?
Third?
Like, there's been a third shooting at a gas station up in Aspen Hill. And I think I cursed aloud. I was like, what the hell is going on?
I'm sure you did.
And they're like, get out. You're going to the mobile station on Connecticut Avenue up near Aspen Hill. And Doug Wilkes, a photographer, and I got in a car and headed up there. And it was the beginning of 3 weeks of sheer madness in this area.
It was. And here we are now, some 20 years later, looking back on that time when really everyone we knew was in the grip of fear and disbelief.
The sniper started his spree last week on Wednesday, firing a shot into the Michael's craft store in Aspen Hill. No one was hurt. However, less than an hour later, the sniper killed a man in Silver Spring. The next morning, the carnage continued in Rockville, where a man was killed. And within 90 minutes of that shooting, the sniper killed three more people in Montgomery County, two at gas stations, one at Leisure World.
Fox 5's Bob Barnard and Melanie Alnwick are following different aspects of the intense investigation. We begin now with Bob.
You should take a look behind me. This is the gas station, the mobile gas station. The vehicle you can see there is a silver minivan that is behind the police tape. That's the van that the nurse was in. There is blood, frankly, on the splattered on the other side of that van. On the other side of the van, still parked at the pumps, is the cabbie's car.
My hands were shaking, and I got out of the car, and I called 911. And I saw the taxi driver was laying down, and there was a lot of blood. And I was trying to explain to the 911 operator where I was and what had happened. If I had got out immediately, grabbed my bag, got out, and not being a little bit nosy and what's that guy doing, then it would have been 50-50 who he would have shot.
That same night, the sniper killed his sixth victim in the district this time.
It could be any one of us. Sitting on the front porch, it could be us, could be me, could be you, could be anybody.
What's the matter with him? He just got shot. Help me! Are you okay, Iron? Okay.
The spree continued, though, Monday morning with the shooting of a 13-year-old student in Prince George's County. That boy remains in critical condition.
And I was gasping for air. I was turning pale. I was losing so much blood. I had to roll the window down to help me breathe. It was an intense moment. I truly thought I was going to die.
This is where the bullet actually pierced me. This was all immediate surgery. These here looks like other bullet wounds. They was just like maybe bags of blood. They had to feed me through my veins, essentially, because if I would have eaten or drinking anything, I could have choked on myself.
Then Wednesday night, the sniper took down a man in Manassas. The hit happened just after 8 o'clock last night at the Sunoco gas station in Manassas. Now, if the shooting is in fact linked to the sniper killings, this will be the 10th unexplained shooting in a row. The victim in this case, a well-liked 53-year-old civil engineer.
I didn't really think it was, you know, in my neighborhood. And right there, that's just, it's scary.
10 shots fired, 9 people struck, 7 killed. The addition of Prince William County to the shooter's fields of prey has strengthened the task force's size and resolve.
On given days, we might be trailing with teams of federal and local officials, 16, 18 people on a given day. What generally ended the surveillance on those suspects would be another shooting.
They basically killed everybody. That was the randomness. You know, there was no rhyme or reason to it. They just killed everybody. Maximum fear.
Chaos follows the apparent trail of the serial sniper. Traffic is slowed to a crawl, plans are canceled, and businesses are feeling the effects of communities in lockdown.
Is your husband shot?
My wife.
Where's she been shot?
She shot in the head.
You should understand that I hope to God that someday we'll know why all of this occurred. Thank you.
And just hearing that, seeing it, if you're watching the video, it really does bring me back to that time. And I know you too. We were just so involved in it and wanting to get people all the information. And the anchors at the time, too. So if you're hearing that, you may recognize some of those voices. Tracy Neal, Laura Evans, Will Thomas, who spent so much time there at Montgomery County Police Headquarters covering the breaking developments. And also in this podcast, we're going to talk to some of the people and their remembrances of the time. But we're going to also go into places we hadn't heard before, hear some of those untold stories from investigators and other people who witnessed this firsthand.
And some of those 911 calls, I mean, my goodness. It does take you back, obviously. You know, when you hear those heartbreaking calls and some of the people you may have not heard from before, we heard a couple of voices, including Iron Brown, the then 13-year-old who was shot and badly wounded there outside his middle school in Prince George's County. You know, witnesses to the murders, survivors of the sniper's deadly aim. Dr. Carolyn Namro, who you heard there, she watched in horror one of the 5 murder victims get shot on that fateful first day, October 3rd, really. A part-time cab driver named Prem Kumar Walaker, he was shot at a gas station right before her eyes.
I did realize it was a gunshot. And then I looked up. So that's why I hadn't got out of my car immediately, was because I stopped to look at him and I had to get my credit card out. And then he walked to me. So it was only a matter of 2 or 3 steps to my car. And he was at the passenger window and he said, call an ambulance, and he collapsed.
Dr. Namro goes on to describe the sheer terror she felt for days after that, wondering whether the killer or killers had seen her and would come after her family somehow for some reason. It's chilling stuff. I also interviewed Iron Brown. He's the teenager I mentioned, a 13-year-old boy, a middle school student from Prince George's County, shot and severely wounded by the snipers as he arrived at school. That was Benjamin Tasker Middle School in Prince George's County in Bowie. That was on October 7th, 2002, that first week of the killing spree. Iron was being dropped off by his aunt in front of the school.
And essentially, as soon as I got out of her car, it happened that fast. And of course, you just heard a loud bang as if a grenade went off. And immediately, I knew I was shot. Of course, with me never being shot before, I guess intuition and just instincts just kicked in. And one thing led to another, and next thing you know, I was just fighting and grasping for air, and that day forever changed me.
Iron will tell you what he remembers about that day and the weeks that followed as he recovered from very serious injuries. He was shot in the stomach. Iron Brown is now 33 years old, a father, and living near Atlanta. Later in the series, you'll hear from a man named Mike Bouchard. He was the head of the ATF in Maryland at the time of the killings. He was one of the people we heard from on a daily basis back in 2002, updating the world on the mind-boggling manhunt for the snipers. Here's Mr. Bouchard describing what it was like when the killers first started leaving clues at the murder scenes.
Once they left the tarot card and said, call me God, all the subsequent shootings they communicated or left something behind to let us know it's us. And, you know, it was a mind game that they were playing with us. You know, in my opinion, they felt they had control and they could manipulate us standing before the cameras. You know, early on, they were doing 5-6 press conferences a day, and we talked with our public information officers and Chief Moose, and we said, if they're getting off on vanity for the publicity of this whole thing, let's just cut it back. We're going to do one a day. Regardless if it's a shooting or not, we're not going to reward them by having a press conference and having us go up there and talk about these guys.
Mike's now retired and living in Williamsburg, Virginia. More from him in a later episode. And I want to share with you a brief part of our interview with Tim Meacham. He was a police officer in Ashland, Virginia. That's down near Richmond. He was the first officer to arrive at the scene of the shooting of Jeffrey Hopper outside a Ponderosa steakhouse. This was during the three-week-long killing spree right off I-95. Hopper was wounded as he left the restaurant with his wife. The snipers again leaving behind a note from their perch in a wooded area near the restaurant.
They had asked for $10 million. And they wanted it to be put on a specific platinum visa, I believe it was. And they provided the credit card number and the pen and everything you needed. And they demanded this ransom. And they said, if catching us is more important, get your body bags. And then that's when they made the threat to, they did, they said, get your body bags. And they made this threat to the children. Your children are not safe anywhere, anytime.
Meaning, give us the money, don't try to catch us.
Correct.
Now, you may remember schools in that area were closed for a couple of days after that shooting. That was on October 19th, 3 days before the last killing of the ride-on bus driver Conrad Johnson, 5 days before Lee Boyd Malvo and John Allen Muhammad were arrested and captured. It was, you know, right coming to an end there, but not quite, sadly.
And you also mentioned, and when we heard from the investigator about the note tacked to the tree. I mean, that, I think, to me, was one of the most lasting impressions of this as someone who's covering it and getting information from police headquarters, how these guys were, we assumed guys, taunting the police, leaving these little notes. When we found out about that tarot card, the death card.
That was at the Iron Brown shooting
at the middle school. That was so creepy to me. I don't think I'd ever been witness to something like that before. And then being at police headquarters when Chief Moose said, your children are not safe.
Your children are not safe anywhere at any time.
That was the kind of thing that gave me goosebumps. I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. And then in researching the podcast, we're going back through, we pulled all kinds of archival file and sound, and I found that call that Lee Boyd Malvo made to what he thought was the Ponderosa Steakhouse. The call had actually been rerouted. The number had been rerouted to an FBI line.
Because he said he was going to call, right?
Because he said in that note, we will contact you at the Ponderosa Steakhouse at 6 a.m. So
they didn't want a store manager or an employee to pick up that
call.
These
are things we didn't know at the time that we're now learning in the background and going through the case. And so we want you to hear, again, just what that call sounded like.
Hello?
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 Yes.
Is this the Ponderosa?
Who is this?
Don't say anything. Just listen.
Learned something that I'm kind of glad I didn't know back then. Remember, we were talking about being at Montgomery County Police Headquarters.
Sure.
And I always felt, as a reporter, that I was relatively safe there. I don't know how you felt out.
In numbers, yeah. Maybe you were a target, but I didn't feel that way. I felt like we were getting all our information. All reports from around the world were there in the parking lot on Research Boulevard in Rockville.
But I felt safer at that location.
I agree.
Than when I was a single reporter out by myself at night, and they would say, well, just go to a shopping center somewhere with your photographer. We don't want you at police headquarters where everybody is.
Yeah, go stand out in a spotlight like a, yeah.
I'm out here in the dark, lit up like a Christmas tree. I'm amazed. Any one of us could have been a target. So I thought that Montgomery County Police Headquarters was the safer place to be. And when I interviewed John McCarthy, I found out that maybe that wasn't the case.
One of the terrifying things that, as we found out later on, is we used to have the press conferences right out in front. And we realized these were snipers. There were buildings. We were standing out in front of the building. Anybody who was could have gone to any one of the adjoining buildings and picked off anybody in front of us. We ultimately put counter-terrorist people up on top of those buildings to make sure that we wouldn't be shot at the press conference.
So imagine that, making sure people wouldn't be shot at the press conference.
Crazy. I know.
It's hard to put the feelings back into it because you can't know what you didn't know.
And you didn't know where they were going to be next, right?
I mean, right.
These guys were going from Maryland to Virginia, back to Maryland. I mean, they were all over the place. I'll tell you what, the two men who I've spoken to during this the research for this podcast, it'll be coming up in a later episode, are men like the rest of us living in fear for a few weeks, and then they were assigned to represent Lee Boyd Malvo. They're two Northern Virginia lawyers. Malvo was charged in the murder of Linda Franklin. She was an FBI analyst who was shot in the parking lot of the Home Depot in Falls Church, right next to her husband. Here is some of our interview with those two lawyers. You'll hear more of them coming up in a later episode.
This was a good person, a good young adult who got into the wrong hands and was vulnerable. And as we said earlier, it was the perfect storm, bad storm of factors, and it ruined his life. And it's a sad situation. That doesn't minimize the fact that, you know, these people were shot and killed. It was a horrible time in many ways. But he also had his life ruined by John Muhammad.
I also had the opportunity to sit down with Mildred Muhammad, John Muhammad's ex-wife. We talked about her relationship with John, how it changed, the fight to get her children back. Can you imagine what that's like to have your children kidnapped by your ex-husband and taken to a foreign country? We talked about how she got them back, how they came here to the Washington, D.C. area to rebuild their lives and try to hide from John. I also talked to her about the night that the FBI knocked on her door and told her that John was going to be named the DC sniper.
So the agent walked in, put his phone down and say, look, Miss Muhammad, we're just gonna have to tell you. We're gonna name your ex-husband as the sniper. I said, what, John? They said, yes, my head hit the table. I said, well, do you think he would do something like this? I raised my head, I looked in the corner. Yeah. He said, well, why would you think that? I said, well, we were watching a movie. I don't remember the name of it, but he said, I could take a small city, terrorize it. They would think it would be a group of people and it would only be me.
You know, one of the crazy things for me at the time was that we would hear there's another shooting and we'd be sent there. And in the back of our mind, wondering, okay, is this definitely another sniper shooting or is it another crime? I mean, because other people, sadly, at the time were killing people. It was usually, though, like at a gas station, a public place. You kind of had a feeling, even though you didn't know for sure that this was the next killing or shooting committed by the snipers, you know, that this is probably going to be it. And we treated it that way. And then the response from the police was that way. And it was usually at some point later in the day or night when they'd say, yes, the ballistics, you know, Mike Bouchard from the ATF will talk about that. The ballistics,
two,
they were able to say, yep, okay, this is another one. You're like, we've been here all day telling our viewers that we think it is. And then you hear, sadly, that yes, this is another one of those. I will say, just contemporarily today, anytime personally or on the job, I'm driving up Connecticut Avenue from, you know, the D.C. area, Bethesda, what have you, north. And I pass, it's now a Sunoco station, but it was that mobile gas station there in Aspen Hill on Connecticut Avenue just before it merges again with Georgia Avenue. Every time I think of being there that day, because on that October 3rd day when the cab driver was killed at that gas station, that's where that was the first little command post. It was the third of four daytime shootings that day. There was one more that night. But that's where we ended up going. and where the police went and the prosecutors. John McCarthy was there. Chief Moose was there. And that's, and so I can't help every to this day going by there and thinking that. But also, you know, for us, it's a memory. It kind of comes and goes. But for so many people who lost somebody, witnessed one of the shootings and its immediate aftermath, who were part of the frustrating manhunt for those killers during those 3 weeks in October 2002, the Beltway sniper case remains a sorrowful and harrowing part of their daily consciousness.
Absolutely. And you know, what's really interesting to me also is what was going on behind the scenes. You're talking about waiting for those press conferences to come and getting the information. And we know now this whole, they took that command center from Aspen Hill and they set up an entire, literally an entire investigative bureau overnight where there were different rows, different, a tip would come in, those tips get vetted, it goes to another person, it goes to another, you know, and so we're going to hear more of that from John McCarthy as well. And also what's interesting is the things, like you said, the things you didn't know. That's what we're learning a little bit more about. And a lot of people who weren't really closely following the murder trials, as we're doing all of this, even when you look in the FBI files, they say that this began on October 3rd.
Right.
But then we come to find out that that's really not the case. Muhammad and Malvo were in the area earlier, and even soon, even before September, they were methodically planning this out and practicing their plans. And I spoke to a man, Paul Arufa. He is actually the very first victim of the DC snipers. He was shot in early September, a month before the mass shooting started happening. And here's some of what he told me.
Well, I shut the door, and within several seconds, the window next to me exploded. There was a big bang, which deafened my ear, my left ear, and the window exploded all over me. That was the first shot, and then there were four more shots, and I was shot, which was just the most confusing, mentally confusing thing. I mean, you know what's happening, but it's just so crazy that you can't comprehend it, but I knew it, you know, and I slumped over in the seat, and I knew I was bleeding.
So Bob, you know, this happened outside of his restaurant in Clinton, Maryland. Turns out it was really just about a mile from where Mildred Muhammad had been hiding with her children in that townhouse. It was assumed to be an armed robbery, but no one really had connected the dots until Paul LaRuffa's laptop was found in the back of the Chevy Caprice.
Oh my goodness.
When Malvo and Muhammad were finally arrested. So you're gonna hear more from Paul LaRuffa coming up in episode 2 of our podcast, 3 Weeks of Hell, the DC Snipers.
And you can find this, we're glad you're hearing us now, but you can find this podcast on all podcast platforms and also through our website, fox5dc.com. We hope you come along on our journey.